Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Japan's greatest victory, Britain's worst defeat, the capture of Singapore in 1942 by Colonel Mansubu Suji. He's the mastermind. We're up to chapter 20. It's been a little bit of a break as I've had to do other things, go off to medical appointments and things like that. But so far the Japanese have arrived. You can sort of get swept away by the colonel's description, but there's sort of some other basic truths here that the Indian forces they're facing are not, I can tell it from my background, haven't been trained in night fighting. They haven't been they're not very disciplined, so what happens is they produce a lot of firing at night, and in general they can't hit a barn door at night, so being able to operate in the night and in the jungle takes a lot of training. It takes months and months of training, and I'm not going to disclose how what I've been trained, partly because it's probably out of date, but also it's the last thing you want to know is get people knowing how to fire at night. But in general, the eye, sections of the eye that you use during the day are useless at night. And so if you get a rifle and point it at night, in general, it's almost impossible to aim. You use a different part of your eyesight, and there's a different method of holding a rifle at night and firing at night, and night operations. And in general, the Australian Army in the desert in 1942, or the 1941, had been trained in night fighting. So you can see that these people haven't been trained in night fighting. Also, and the Japanese are perfectly at calm at night, and they're mentally on top of the game, whereas the British are all falling apart at the seams. And you can imagine these people have been fighting for 10, 20 years, continuously fighting, continuously going from one battle to the next. If it's not in Manchuria, it's in China. If it's not in China, it's some other place. They've just been, it's just a warfare culture. The other thing is that you pick up, like this person, he wrote this book. He disappeared for a while, wrote this book, and then he, again, if you read inside the cover, he again disappeared and melted into Southeast Asia. So a lot of these things, a lot of these people, they're ideal soldiers for the beginning of World War II, but when push comes to the shove, they're not people as we sort of understand them. So the Japanese prisoners of war, a lot of them just committed suicide at, Kara. We had a few prisoner of war camps here, Kara, or when the Australians finally got over the top of the Papua New Guinea and went and pincered them on the coast, the whole regiments, hundreds of Japanese would have all committed suicide. So a lot of the soldiers, it's unheard of, these soldiers so motivated. If you read some of the stories, in order to take a pillbox, some soldiers just put themselves up as human shields to kill themselves going forward. This is insane warfare. So there's a large number of things which aren't going the Indians and the British troops' ways, but the British troops, although they know, you can see by the amount of explosives and firepower, they're really ready for the Japanese to come, but they haven't, they've got rid of, in terms of the actual stuff on the ground, but they haven't actually trained their soldiers. And of course, with the hindsight, there's a huge amount of training for night patrols. In fact, almost all the training is you patrol at night almost all the time and train to fight at night. And these soldiers that they're up against just simply haven't been trained to fight at night. There's no leadership, if Right. Another interesting thing is that obviously this has happened all too quickly, but you want to rotate your commanders from your military schools into the field, military schools into the field. And these people have, the Japanese have achieved that because they've been fighting for so long. And this is such that the realistic information, this can be actually not just facts coming out, the actual personnel rotate into your military schools and can start to train people up, and then people can pick up other ideas and bring it in. It's that sort of fluid method here. And so you can see here that these people really haven't answered. Now, this is chapter 20, A Chance to Exploit, and I believe the Japanese fighting sort of know how to fight at night. Now, also, night means that you don't need a superiority of numbers, but you also don't have air cover and things like that. In the dead of night, a single shot was suddenly fired in the path of the column, a shot in answer to a shot. Identical red flares ascended from right to left, to front and rear. As if to answer the signal, a barrage fell in front and the rear of the column for a time, held us up in advance. Medium tanks, which had made their wild and disorderly attack, were blocked at the approach to a demolished bridge and brought a closely packed column to a standstill on the road. This was resistance in earnest. In daylight, it would be dreadful to be held in such a position by superior military artillery. It's amazing. Lieutenant Colonel Saki alighted from his car on the left side of the road and walked about amongst the rubber trees to stretch his legs. "We'll have to break through this evening," he said, and I agreed in this opinion, and a number of patrols were sent to locate the enemy guns. Before long, one returned. A line of advance through the enemy fortified position is not difficult, the patrol officer reported. There are wire entanglements, but there are gaps between them. The enemy troops are not yet in position. It seems as if night attack would be possible. See, all night attack. That's a quote. This was the most important matter. The young second lieutenant who gave us the report was a handsome youth of rather feminine appearance, as we would see by the glow of his electric torch. His name was Otto. It appeared that he had crept into the enemy line on the way back and had killed a sentry who was posted at the other end of the bridge. His coat was stained with the enemy's blood. Judging by the artillery fire, the resistance we encountered came from a fairly powerful force, but according to the report, the second lieutenant, there was a chance of making a successful night attack, which was just what we wished to do. One way or another, by the break of day, we would find our way out of the position in which we found ourselves. Our troops were rather uneasy, but this report was as good as a boat for the crossing. Perhaps there was even a possibility of success. Without delay, the order for a night attack was given to the Nagi Number 1 Company, which was led by Second Lieutenant Otto. The Nagi Company moved along the road in darkness, turning towards the sound of the guns. The enemy artillery became exceedingly activity. We retaliated by moving towards the enemy's position from the front road. And a violent battle developed, extending all along the line. Judging from the sound, the enemy seemed to have 40 or 50 guns. It would be possible to do as we hoped and break through his line with a Seeker detachment of barely 500 men, had not the second lieutenant Otto treated the enemy rather lightly. Shortly afterward, the enemy shell fire became concentrated on the rubber plantation around the detachment headquarters. The enemy appeared to bombard this area at night as a precautionary measure, irrespective of whether or not there was an objective to be fired on. The big rubber trees set up a frightful sound as one another as they were split. The position of the headquarters had to be changed frequently. Clearly, the military situation was not developing at all. Just before dawn, the reserve unit, Number 2 Company, was thrown into the battle line. We had no more reserves. Day dawned gradually. In the daylight, it seemed the worst possible had happened. Keeping the matter to oneself makes one depressed in spirit. More than half of the rubber trees had been mown down, and the places in which one could take cover were gradually being narrowed down. But 5 o'clock, a soldier from the front line returned to report the upper half of his body was bloodstained. Standing motionlessly before the detachment, the commander said, "The company commander, sir, has been killed in action, and there are many casualties, but all is well." As he came into the end of his report, he fell. The surgeon examined him and found that he had been wounded through the chest. He had faithfully returned his report and collapsed seriously wounded. It was an astonishing position. It would be a fatal to assault based on the optimistic but half-doubted report of the second Lieutenant Otto. Although knowing intuitively that the enemy was a tough one, we had forced the night attack because of our fear of becoming involved in the difficulties after dawn. But the night attack had been unsuccessful, and the dawn had come without waiting for us. Furthermore, the main strength of the division was in the distance rear. There might not be time to prepare for this emergency. There would have to be a little more careful guidance. Thoughts of self-condemnation overwhelmed my heart. Our lives would have been to compensate for our errors. Searching everywhere for the enemy's weak point, we grew increasingly impatient as full daylight came. On the line of the road, our 10 medium tanks and light armoured vehicles had become the target of superior enemy artillery. The number of blood-covered wounded in retreat along the drainage ditch had increased. Before long, there came an officer smeared in mud and blood. He came close, I recognised him. He was Second Lieutenant Otto, who had given us the first report in the previous evening. "Hello," I called. "It's only a slight flesh wound, cheer up." Unconsciously, breaking the run into a run as he drew near, he came up and grasped my hand. "Staff officer, sir, it is excusable. Otto has made a mistake in his estimate of the enemy's strength." His tears were falling like rain. Was the wound on his right shoulder from a hand grenade? The flesh, deep red with like a pomegranate, was swollen. His face was pale, as if all the blood had drained out of it. "Don't worry," I said. "We can win this battle." While sympathising the second lieutenant and increasing my own excitement, I put into his mouth a broken piece of chocolate which had been left in the bottom of my map pouch. The second lieutenant's hot tears trickled down and fell on his mud-covered hands. "Everything's all right," I assured him. "Get to the rear quickly and get well." Putting him on a hastily constructed stretcher, the men carried him away, treading their way through the lull in shell fire as they moved towards the rear. There had been no report whatsoever of the two companies which had penetrated the enemy line the previous evening. They might have been counterattacked by superior enemy forces or perhaps annihilated. Somehow or another, we had to find a way out of our difficulties. For the left wing, I walked alone into the rubber trees and saw a strange ghostly circle like a scale of glassy thicket. Looking at it carefully, I saw it was a landmine area with the front covered by wire entanglements and surrounded by two or three lines of them. How far this strong line extended, it seemed to stretch without limit. The section on which we had made our night raid was a narrow front less than 100 metres across the main road. The position in front seemed solid. Deep forces capable of holding out for several months, it seemed absolutely beyond our power to break through. With impatient feelings, I returned to the original detachment headquarters, and Lieutenant Colonel Seiki, which with a grave expression, said to me, "Mr. Shuji, as commanding officer, I cannot live. By my error in estimation of the enemy movements, I have made a lifelong failure. A great many of men under my command have been backslidden. I will now leave for the front line. I mean what I say." My God, I was right about these suicide. They're mad. I replied, quote, "This is a battle conducted by the Chief of Army Operations Staff. If there is a failure, the whole responsibility falls on me, but the position is not yet desperate. Let's try to break the deadlock. Please wait a while." And thus, with difficulty, I consoled him. If Colonel Seiki were killed, I felt we could not go on living, or without a moment's delay, we'd have to bring forward the main strength of the division. But under the heavy bombardment, it seemed there's no passage through which the telephone message or orderly. Quote, "Kindly lend me your car," I said to Colonel Seiki. "Mr. Suchi," he replied, "through this shell fire? How?" Seeing I was doubtful with the prospects of a car getting through the barrage area, I pushed it back, jumped into the car with the driver and drove off in full speed, safely breaking through the barrage. Shells burst close in front of the rear, to the left and to the right, and often the body of the vehicle rose from the ground, but mysteriously, no shell hit the car. Oh my God, he is a sacred samurai. About 4 kilometers in the rear, Major General Kumara, already uneasy about the artillery fire so close at hand, had not yet accelerated to move forward the main body of our troops. My God, it keeps on going. How many pages is this? Oh, it's a long thing. It was a little after noon when we arrived at the rear headquarters of the Seiki detachment. Taking a survey patrol in my car, I again drove through the barrage after passing on the alarm to Colonel Okabe, commander of the Okabe Regiment, who was paused for lunch among the rubber trees. We urged the artillery regimental commander to get his guns to position speedily. Our party suddenly became filled with enthusiasm. The survey patrol, the eyes of the artillery, moved to a point just behind the front line. Another direction, the guns began to rain well-aimed shells on the enemy position. Gradually appeared we had extracted ourselves from a critical position. Soon after, the Okabe Regiment deployed a battalion to the left of the Saki Regiment and then made a detour to the rear of the enemy. Oh my God. We now perhaps evenly matched with our opponents. However, as daylight of the attack was difficult, the divisional commander decided to wait until sunset, see the nighttime fighting. Meantime, putting our full strength into the order of a night attack. The sun was sinking, the preparations for the night attack had been completed when, unexpectedly, there came a report from the front line. The enemy soldiers are retreating. Rapidly advancing, with not a hair's breadth between the regiments ahead of us, we rushed in over the heads of a crumbling enemy. From the reports of the prisoners, we knew we were at the Jicho line, and this position had taken roughly 6 months to construct. It was defended by one division, which had been believed be able to stem the advance of the Japanese army for at least 3 months! The Jicho line garrison comprised Main Road 15th Brigade, Leicester's and Gurkha's, Main Road East Surrey's and Punjab's. Oh my godfather, no Aussies there at least. Rapidly advancing with, the casualties of the 2nd Detachment had been 27 killed in action, 83 wounded, a total of 110 men. The enemy retreated, leaving behind souvenirs, about 50 field guns, 50 heavy machine guns, and about 300 trucks and armoured cars, and provisions with ammunition for division for 3 months. Casualties suffered by the enemy were not clear to us, but over 3,000 surrendered after having thrown away their arms in panic and taken refuge in the jungle, or from which were driven out by hunger after several days. The majority of these were Indian soldiers. My God. Breakthrough of the digital arm was due to extraordinary tactics and an error in the report of our first patrol. It had judged that this well-fogged position correctly launched a full-scale attack with the whole strength of the division and became locked in a struggle. It would have taken 10 days to break through, and we would have had to prepare for over 1,000 casualties. The much bragged about Jitra line, which had been defended by a division for 3 months, was penetrated in about 15 hours by barely 500 men. If the handsome, pitiful 2nd Otto had not reported wrongly, even the courageous commander of the 2nd Department could not have expected to make such a reckless attack. And utterly the glorious export, it would have been considered common sense. It could not have even been considered common sense. But often actual conditions on the battlefield determine the hazardous issues. Our success was due to the intangible belief in victory resulting from the scores of the substantial factors. Oh God, it's horrible to read. Thoroughly equipped forces which we had seen our way to attack caused fear, and even now, after so long a time, I can still feel. The wire entanglements were spread in several lines. The innumerable trenches were deep. Shells were piled up like mountains, as too were gasoline, provisions, and ammunition. However, all this exaggerated the strength of the Jitra position. The officers, the men who in barrackation had been living on dry bread and salt, had been fighting for several days, found tobacco, cakes, tinned food piled up chock full of storehouses of rubber plantation. They were, however, disappointed. There was no time to waste. So, with rifles slung on their shoulders and with as much food as tobacco they could carry each in their hand, they hurried along the road south. Churchill allowance is a delicacy, isn't it? They commented as they continued their advance, forgetting even they were timed. Before long, the storehouse was taken over by our communications units. Considering things from the practical angle, the communications unit did not wait at the landing point at Singora or unloading of ammunition, provisions and gasoline. So without waiting for transport, each man had moved to the front with dry bread and rice sufficient for only a few days in accordance with the plan. Depend upon the enemy for rations. Quote, we had to be grateful General Percival not only for provisions for the men, but also for cars and gasoline abandoned in abundance. It would, if such tactics would these were kept up, then our fighting officers and men would not go hungry. Speaking to an English engineer, officer taken, oh my God. Prisoner, I asked, how long did you think the fortified position would hold out? He replied, held by full strength, the Liver Division, I believe it would hold out for 3 months at least. The reason? With the jungle and swampy ground as a natural obstacle on both sides of the road, Northern Malaya was made for the defence zone with three lines of entrenchment, which took our engineers 6 months to construct. As the Japanese army had not beaten weak Chinese army after 4 years of fighting in China, we did not consider it a very formidable enemy. Asked what roughly was the disposition of his troops in the Jitra line, he replied, in effect, there were three lines, utilizing the swamps and the front line. We obstructed the approach to the Japanese army by blowing up the bridges, which caused delay. This was called the Atan line. For the second line, the principal position, we used the jungle to the full equipment with wire entanglements, landmines, and anti-tank trenches. This line constructed very solidly, building the third line deep at the rear. We used contours of the land to the fullest extent. What was the reason for the feeble breakdown? God only knows. To attack this position, you'd have to have more than one division. It seems that knowing a large force was already landing, a Japanese army rushed into attack. I thought they made a detour to our rear. I said, we really made a night attack with less than 500 men. That was very fearless, she replied. What about your divisional commander? Then I asked him about all he could say and whereabouts were unknown. The second lieutenant Otto, whose report had launched the attack, was sent back to the rear to Saigon Field Operation Hospital, but he developed gangrene and died. I had the feeling that the flower which had just bloomed was shattered in the storm of one night. When I returned to Japan at the end of the war, Otto's brother one evening paid an unexpected visit to my small house. He looked exactly like the second lieutenant. He owned a large wine shop at Mula in Bichum and bought me some homemade wine as a present. I'm extremely worried about my younger brother. On patrol, misjudged the enemy's position and so caused the sacrifice of so many of our officers' men. Please tell me the truth, he said, with his anxious expression on his face. Unconsciously, I straightened myself. The newspaper article which reported my talks just after my return had reported incorrectly and thus caused much suffering. No, I said, his report was surely not the correct one. But that was because he was too brave and crept into the enemy's position so easily that he judged their strength to be much weaker than it was. If at the time he had reported the position as unusually strong, even the Japanese army may not have made such a reckless night attack. However, the division brought the matter to conclusion with the loss of 100 men. Afterwards, I met Otto's mother. I gave deep feeling for the children of his mother, the elder brother and younger brother. I feel sorry even today for the loss of such a valuable youth. Okay, that's the end of chapter 20. Podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.